Welcome to the Edu All-Stars Podcast.
Welcome, guys, to our 19th episode of Edu All-Stars. I'm Todd Nesloney here with you. I'm Tech Ninja Todd on Twitter. My co-hosts today are...
I'm Tech Ninja Stacy, or Stacy Huffine.
And my name is Chris Kessler. You can find me at I Am Kessler on Twitter.
And we are really excited today to have Salome Thomas L., also known as Principal L., on Twitter. He is an award-winning teacher and principal in the Philadelphia School District for over 20 years and is currently the head of school at Thomas Edison Charter in Williamton, Delaware. He's also an educational and media consultant. He visits schools around the country to consult with principals and teachers, and he is also a contributor for the Dr. Oz Show and author of the best-selling book I Choose to Stay. So thank you, Principal L, for coming on with us today. We greatly appreciate it.
Oh, it is an honor and a pleasure, and I can tell right away that I'm going to have a lot of fun tonight.
We try.
let's go ahead and start it out. We usually want a little bit of background, you know, about you and kind of how you got into education. So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I grew up in Philly, typical kid in a large family, single mom. And my teachers really were a major influence in my life early on in my childhood, because as a kid growing up in a struggling family, you begin to, as you guys all know, kids really count on school to sort of become their second home and sometimes their first true home. And my mother walked in my elementary teachers and said, I was the next to the youngest kid in the family. It was eight of us. And said, my older brothers and, sisters are not, going to college and graduating. That one of her kids must graduate from college. And those teachers sort of adopted me. My third grade teacher was a young white female, was not from our community, but she was just so typical of those teachers who would come in and say Private Ryan every day. That was their mentality. And she worked with my fourth grade teacher, was an older African-American female, been at our school about 30 years. We thought she came with the building. And they helped me to get into a middle magnet school for gifted kids. And I went on, they knew I was struggling, but they supported me. I went on to high school, started playing high school basketball, thought I could skip college and go right to the NBA. And my teacher says, son, you can't jump over a credit card. You're not going to the NBA. It said, but you're smart enough to get an MBA. So, why don't you go away to college and come back and help the same community that supported you and your mom. And I did that, came back, but I got a job in television, was working in sports TV, and went to a career day at a high school and went to speak to some kids. The kids didn't want to know my name. They wanted to know, how much money did Larry Bird have and how many cars did Michael Jordan own. But there were a few kids after the program who came to me and said, if you can come in and motivate us, how come you aren't a teacher? And it was the first time in my life that someone had asked me a question. I had no response at all, not my coaches, my mom, my professors, no one. Some young people had taught me that I had become the same person I complained about who made it out of the community. The community supported you, nurtured you, and you came back to give nothing. And I quit my TV job, enrolled in graduate school, and got a certificate and started teaching and never looked back.
Wow.
That's awesome. I love that story. Well, I know that you taught for a while. What did you teach when you were still in the classroom?
I was a mathematics teacher. I started teaching special education students math on the chessboard. So I started teaching a high school and realized that high school reform does not begin in the ninth grade. 50% of the kids who drop out in the ninth grade or before. So if we really want to help change the situation in our nation and change the course of how we're educating children in our schools, we must begin to focus on children when they're much younger. K through 8, pre-K, early childhood education. And so I said I would dedicate a good part of my life to helping elementary and middle school kids. And so I spent the next 10 years of my life teaching middle school kids. And in 10 years of teaching middle school in the community where I work, we lost almost 20 kids to murder in our community, and it was very tough for me to see that, but it helped me to learn early on that children need to learn that they can choose the behavior, but they can't choose the consequences. Right. And that's why I started teaching these children mathematics on a chessboard. Knights move on right angles. Bishops move on diagonals. The chessboard is a large square that contains 64 smaller squares. But it also teaches kids to that there are consequences for every move, but also rewards. To think 2-3 moves ahead. These are all great life skills. But didn't realize that I was also giving these students intellectual capital. They were walking around the school. Yeah, they could play chess. But kids also thought that they were smart. So I learned as a teacher early on that smart is not something you are, it's something you can become. This was the growth mindset early in life. And those kids just were just fabulous. And I enjoy being able to bring math alive for kids. So I mix in a lot of rhymes that we'll get some satisfaction from solving this fraction. You know, just making it fun, you know, for kids, but also some of those students actually went on to become pretty good, you know, pretty good chess players.
Well, I love this you wrote something for Education Week, and you said, the next time President Barack Obama and U.S. Secretary of Education Arne Duncan are sitting together discussing education reform, I hope that it will be across the table from one of my elementary or middle school students. If so, there will inevitably be a chessboard between them, and I'm certain my students will win every match. I loved that. Is chess something that you've always enjoyed, or that you recently that you grew into as you became an educator?
You know, when I was young, my brother taught me how to play, but he only taught me enough moves so he could continue to beat me. And you know, that's what older brothers do, you know. But when after graduating college and realizing I started really studying chess and how mathematical chess is, but also how artistic combinations in chess are, that I just said there's got to be a way to be able to transfer these same skills, you know, or at least the ability to play, mesh it with skills that children learn, you know, in school. And I sort of made chess part of the curriculum. It's actually part of my curriculum now in my elementary school. My third, fourth, and fifth graders must take a chess algebra course. That's mandatory. I have an elective course for my middle school kids that they can take a chess course. And then I have about 100 kids who play during the day, you know, and after school. But it just became a passion for me, especially for young children, because, see, chess is something children can teach themselves. So they can learn early on how the pieces move, how to think, you know, just how to think logically, critically. And it's just such a powerful game. Kids who play chess have higher SAT scores, higher ACT scores, higher graduation rates, lower discipline incidents. It's a no-brainer. And my students have beat one of my young ladies beat Arnold Schwarzenegger in the chess match. He came to visit our school bragging about how, you know, he was such a great chess player growing up in Europe and how he makes everybody play. You know, and I said, Arnold, you came to the wrong school bragging about chess. But, you know, he was out promoting this new, you know, he's starting these after school programs in all these schools. And I said, I don't think you realize how good these kids are. And he challenged one of my young ladies. I said, no, first mistake was challenging one of my kids. Second was challenging a girl. Don't fool the girl. And he said, no, I want to play her. I want to play her. I said, and it was one of my young ladies. She was one of the top 50 female chess players in the nation in the age division. Honor roll student, pink glasses. You know, she was in church every Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday. She was powerful. And she checkmated Arnold. Arnold said, you terminated the Terminator. But he wrote a check for our program for $20,000, and we've never received a dime from our school district. And our students have traveled all over the country to play chess, Seattle, Arizona, Florida, Vermont. Our students have even traveled to Yugoslavia to play against the national team.
That's
so
amazing.
It's been a great experience for them, not just playing chess and being competitive, but also the exposure from traveling. There's a major achievement gap, but there's also a major exposure gap.
Right.
So this is a great opportunity for us to close that gap. Most researchers will tell you that the children we work with, the 3/4 of their trips, we will be within 3 miles of their home, you know, by the time they're 18 if they're not going to school. So it's just great for students to have an opportunity to be able to travel, meet kids from all races, all backgrounds, from different parts of the country, different parts of the world. It's been a blessing for me to be able to offer the opportunity to be able to play chess and compete, you know, to my students.
We have quite a few of kids in our community that are the same way, that will probably never leave the community, never leave the state, and it's sad.
Are you guys all in Texas?
Yes.
Wow. Yeah. I'll be in Texas in a few weeks, as a matter of fact.
Well, you need to come say hello.
Yeah, I plan to do that.
Well, after doing all of that, who's influenced you, and when did you really know that you wanted to become an administrator?
My mother was my biggest influence. She's she passed away in 2002. But when I wanted to be a teacher, my mother was just so happy, so excited. You know, she wanted me to follow my own dream. But my mom spent her entire life working with young people. And just when I became a teacher, you know, she just said, just remember, believe in your kids. And I noticed my kids were struggling right away. So I wanted to open up a Saturday program. The school wouldn't let me open on Saturday. So the kids would come to my mom's house on Saturday. She would cook for them. And I would teach them on Saturdays. And it was a way that was the beginning of sort of finding those accelerated learning opportunities for students, giving them time to learn outside of those normal school hours. But when I wanted to become a principal, I called my mom and said, Mom, I want to be an administrator. And she said, Boy, you've lost your mind. She said, what kind of fool would want to supervise adults, right? She said, I can understand you working with children, but why would you want to supervise teachers? I said, Mom, I'm tired of breaking up fights in the lunchroom, in the classroom. She said, don't you know, as an administrator, you will break up more fights between your teachers than you ever have in the lunchroom. But she said, my mom said that if you are going to be a successful administrator, that you have to realize that there will be teachers who have worked in your school for principal after principal after principal, year after year after year, that they're teaching the students of the students that they taught. Go in and bow down to those old ladies, she told me. She said, don't be arrogant. She said, arrogance is the Achilles heel of the school principal. And so I used my mom's speech basically for my script for my first faculty meeting as a principal, but I forgot to edit out the part about the old ladies. So my first year as principal, I spent the entire year buying those old ladies color copies. I tried to buy smart boards before they were invented, you know, just trying to get in their good graces. But that was probably the best advice that I've ever received, really learning and understanding that it is the duty of the administration to serve the people, not the people, the administration. That leadership is about service. If you don't serve, you can't lead. And it's probably what has helped me survive in this business. I've been a principal since 1999, and I've never had a problem with, you know, fixing a teacher a cup of hot tea and lemon if I hear her come in and she's coughing or she's sneezing. I'm up in the room and she's like, oh, principal, you love me. Yes, I love you, but I also covered your class when you were away at professional development, and your class is a handful. Well, I cannot afford to have you absent anymore. But yeah, that was my mom was my biggest inspiration. Then I had some wonderful teachers too in school, Marsha Pincus, Deidre Farnbury, and just a whole host of other folks who really taught me that teaching is the most noble profession in the world, and it's the one way that you can truly make a difference in the lives and be able to influence children and adults for a lifetime. And so it's been a great ride for me, and also getting the opportunity to meet wonderful folks like you and the people on Twitter who, you know, we develop powerful relationships and long-lasting relationships with people right in our own communities, right in our states, but outside of those states, outside of our own learning communities, and outside of this country, that we've, as educators, have been able to create this bond, which I think will just become even more powerful and even larger as time goes on.
So you kind of hit on this a little bit already, but what is kind of one of the most challenging parts of becoming a school administrator, or just being a school administrator?
I think one of the biggest challenges for me is just being able to manage your time so that you're effective. You have your family time, that's so important. But you want the kids in school to know that you're a committed family member, because you want them to grow up and realize that their most important job when they grow up is that they will be good fathers, good moms, great community members. But then they see you working all of the time in school, and then they wonder, are you really a good parent? You know, are you just telling me that? And so finding that balance and then also remaining healthy, being able to minimize the stress, because it's a very stressful, you know, position, because you're just so many things to so many people.
Right.
But I think the reward, you know, just being a person who you know that people can count on, who kids look up to, who teachers will walk through walls for, there's nothing else that I would rather do right now than be able to fight for and advocate for the teachers and children and the educators, you know, who are in my building, but you know, who are in schools everywhere. It can become daunting when you have, you know, staff members who have family members who are sick or who they've lost, or you have staff members yourself who are ill or who you've lost from your staff. But just to know that you're the leader of a group of people who know that we have a tough job, that we have daunting challenges every day, but they rally behind you and they follow you because they know that you are in there fighting right with them. So that's the stress. The stress is being able to manage all of the different roles that you have, but it also is the one thing that you end up appreciating at the end of the day or the end of the school year, is that you're able to impact so many people at so many different levels because you have that responsibility. So any of you aspiring administrators out there in the world,
Chris,
please know and understand it is not an easy job. It's not. But it is one that you should definitely take on, because we have enough leaders in this world, but we do not have enough leadership. We need more people who understand that we need to serve and take care of those who are taking care of children, because they are doing what I call God's work. They're doing the work they're saving lives. And so we need to continue to support them. So you administrators, get ready. Be courageous. Take on those responsibilities, because you are needed, and you will realize that those people will love you and will fight for you and support you.
So you're doing consulting with education and media now. How did that come about?
It's just through exposure, through, you know, coming on to shows like this wonderful show here. And people don't realize how many opportunities come your way without you, you know, seeking those opportunities. I'm still a full-time principal, but I've been able to sort of make my mark, because I take on schools that other principals will refuse to take on many times. So, and my goal is to turn those schools around, schools that are considered for closing, or schools where they're just not successful at times, that I'll go in and use the same staff that's there, same children, and implement what my teachers call Principal L's proven formula for success. And that's simply high expectations for every child, that is challenging curriculum, but also joy and love for every children, every child, every day, elevating and educating children, you know, on a daily basis. And and then I get media and school districts call and say, listen, we have a new principal, or we have a group of principals we'd like you to talk to, and you know, talk about some of the situations you've been in, how you've turned schools around, or how you have difficult conversations, you know, with employees. I have a principal in South Carolina who I'm mentoring now. He's a second going to third year principal, and his school went from one of the lowest performing schools in the school district to one of the highest performing schools in 2 years. And it was wow. Really nothing that I did. It was simply just being there to support him. Most of the support was from long distance, but I did go down and visit his school. He's had a chance to come up and, you know, visit me and just see the message. You know, I just had some principals come visit me from Chicago, from the Chicago area, and I met this young man's father-in-law in Michigan at a reception. He said, my son-in-law just took over a tough school, and I want him to come and visit your school. And he came to visit, And we just get a chance to talk. I mean, they're principals from, you know, Alabama EdChat, who I've gone down to visit. It's just being able to collaborate with these principals and learn from them. And then the word gets out that, hey, listen, just, you know, talk to this guy, talk to these people, you know, what the things that they're saying that work. And it's the same thing that we all talk about, you know, just making sure that we have high expectations, making sure we're teaching children the growth mindset and the adults we work with, you know, as well, making sure children have access to technology, making sure that children have access to challenging programs, that teachers are confidants in the school, that they have meaningful participation in school. But most importantly, making sure what everyone knows is my mantra, that every child has at least one person to be crazy about them. Right. That is my goal, and that's really the message that I want to send around the world. I'm actually leaving for Africa on Sunday, and that is the message that I'm taking to Africa, to Nigeria, from the United States, is that one of the things that we all believe collectively is that we must support every child. Until every child is successful, we know we have lots of work, you know, to do, and we have a great network of educators here, you know, in the States, and we've made it now. Our government is not on board yet, so we've still got to work with these folks in high places.
Right.
Folks that are on the ground, you get it. And we work together. We collaborate. We don't compete. We share with one another. And our students, you know, benefit. And I think that that's the most important thing. And that's one of the things that I talk about when I visit places, is really that collaboration and communication equals a quality and successful education. Notice the rhyme there.
Let's get into your books a little bit. You've got a couple of books, The Immortality of Influence, and then the other is I Choose to Stay. I just wanted to kind of get some background on how you chose those topics and just kind of maybe a little snippet about what each of them are about.
Okay. Well, the first book, I Choose to Stay, is an autobiography. And it's sort of, these book publishers were like, you know, who wants to read a story about a teacher's life? You know, teachers never want to read about other teachers. But I just thought it was important for teachers to hear that one of their students grew up to become a teacher because of their influence. But I also wanted students to know that although the media portrays many negative things about young people, that we're proud of the young people that we work with. They're doing so many positive things. And the book is really about my chess team and all the things that they've done and these teachers who, you know, played a big part, you know, in my life, but also about the many students who I've lost, you know, through violence in the city, and how each and every one of them drives me to continue to do the work that I do and not to give up on our students. And the first book ends, the last chapter ends with a story about a young man named Otis Bullock, who was one of my first chess players, who grew up in a home with many people, a tough background. He went to one of our top Magna high schools, struggled a little, ended up graduating from one of our comprehensive high schools, and lost touch with him. In my first year as principal, he called me, said he was graduating from college, and I didn't believe him. I said, are you sure you're graduating, Otis? He said, yes. I said, you're my first student to graduate from college. And he said, I don't want you to come. He said, the graduation Sunday and the day's Friday. I just want you to let all of my former teachers know that one of their kids made it, Mr. L. And I said, no, you don't understand. I've been to too many funerals. I need to go to more graduations. And so my wife and I made the trip. It was an hour drive, 100-degree heat. We cried through the entire ceremony. Just seeing that young man graduate, and that was in June of 2000, and in May 2004, that same young man, Otis, graduated from Temple Law School, and it was the proudest moment of my life as an educator. And the Immortality book is a follow-up to I Choose to Stay. Arnold Schwarzenegger actually wrote the foreword in I Choose to Stay. After that young lady beat him, I told Arnold that because she won the match, he had to write the foreword in my book when I wrote it, and he actually did. In the second book, The Immortality, I talk more about just about service and just about giving back and our lives as husbands, as fathers, as siblings. Will Smith actually wrote the foreword in the Immortality book.
I saw that.
Yeah, and we're trying to get Will to play me in this movie. Disney purchased the movie rights, and I think Will wanted to kind of have a little more control. So now that Disney no longer has those rights, we both share the same agent. And the agent said that Will's been inquiring about getting a copy of the old script, and so I'm hoping that he now will kind of move forward a little bit, with that. But he's someone that I admire. His mom was a school secretary. Will Smith's very involved with, helping our schools. He paid for some kids in Philadelphia to visit Nelson Mandela in Africa. He's a good family man, and he's actually a chess player too. So I actually took my family to spend the weekend at his house a few years ago, and you can imagine what that weekend was like for my family.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, weekend in L.A. with Will Smith. but it was just great. But I had to tell my daughters, the items that you see in my home that look like they're from other countries, they're really from Target. But what you see in Will's house is really from another country, so don't touch it.
Because we can't afford to replace that.
Right. But yeah, but the immortality is really about how we influence other people in our lives, and even how we influence people and don't even realize it. How even through the way we dress, we send messages, through communication, through how we support other people, that all of those ways that that we influence people, are powerful. And so we must always be cautious of how we are communicating, our body language, the things that we do at work, after work, because people are always watching, especially young people. They're so perceptive. So we have to be careful of that. So that's really a follow-up. And then it's a story of stories about my students from middle school and high school and now in college and law school and grad school and who work. And a few of my former chess students are now teaching at my school. So that's always a great feeling to have your former students work with you as well.
Now, you've mentioned people like Arnold Schwarzenegger, Will Smith, I mean, all these amazing people, and you also do a little bit of work with the Dr. Oz show. What kind of stuff do you do there, and how did that come about?
Sounds crazy, but a few years ago, I got a voice message from someone that said, "Hey, I'm calling from the Oprah Winfrey show, and Oprah would like you to think about working with her and her company." And my daughter heard the message first, and I think she fainted before I did. But I was actually working on a pilot show for the producers of Super Nanny called The Principal, and they sent it around to a few studios. It's going to be a TV show about a principal who, parents or teachers write in and say, "Listen, I've got this great kid, but he never does his homework. He doesn't come to class. He doesn't listen to me. Can Principal L come and straighten my kid out?" And some networks were interested, but it wasn't serious, and we wanted it to be a serious show, and they wanted to kind of make it a comedy. I think TNT, one of the shows, wanted to make it like Parking Wars, and we didn't want that. But Oprah saw the reel and said, "Hey, we like the guy. We like him to come and start working with Dr. Oz. We got a new show we're going to be doing, and we like him to get involved." And so I went to New York because Dr. Oz is taped in New York, and I went and met Dr. Oz, and we hit it off right away. He is a great guy, and so he said, "I really would like to get young people interested in health and nutrition, and just living better, and I'd like to get America interested in that, and I'd like you to be a part of that." And so on the first season, I was on the first team of regular contributors, on the show, and I've been back up to the show after the first season, and we still communicate and talk about different things. He's a great person, great friend. He's a big supporter of my chess program and many of the things. He has some health programs that he does at some high schools, and so I go and visit some of the high schools as well where he's trying to encourage high school students to pursue health careers but also pursue a healthier way of living. So, Dr. Oz is a powerful human being, so down to earth, and I hope that America is really getting the message that we need to live better on the inside and out, So many young people are not eating, you know, healthy. They're not exercising. Schools, and unfortunately, schools, we're not focusing on, you know, phys ed and you know, healthier ways of living. We're focusing more on tests, and our students just don't benefit from that. So I'm hoping I can continue to help to spread that message, especially with through shows like this, which I know will be an Emmy Award-winning show.
That's right. That's right.
I'm just happy to say that I'm one of the first people to be on this show.
Now, you mentioned Oprah. Don't be surprised if, you know, Todd tries to get an in there.
We're that is our big one. We want Oprah on our show. When we get that, oh my gosh!
Now I've been on Oprah Radio, and Todd, let me tell you, if I do ever get on Oprah's show, I'm gonna tell Oprah I gotta bring my right hand man. I'm gonna make sure, I take you with me.
You will be my hero for life if that ever happens. I mean, just if my name even comes up in conversation, much less if I'm there, I'm just like, whoa, okay. Hey, and this is on recording, so all of our viewers heard you say it.
Yes, sir. You can hold me. And I am a man of my word. You can hold me to it.
Now, and I know Todd asked you off the air, but just for the listeners, you know, he did ask.
Because I love this story.
Have you met Oprah?
No, I haven't met Oprah. I've had communication with Oprah. I mean, basically, Oprah's written me a check, and I was telling you guys the story earlier. It took the bank 3 weeks to cash this check. So I went into the bank.
Not because she didn't have the money.
No, right, and it wasn't a check for $1 million. You know, it was something. It would not. This check would not make the bank bounce. And so, I went in and I said, listen, I deposited a check 3 weeks ago. You guys have not credited to my account. And the manager's telling me, oh, you know, that's typical. I said, sir, no, that is not typical. I said, I can guarantee you somebody has that check somewhere and they cannot believe Oprah's name is on that check. I can verify it. You can call anybody you want, but I cannot get evicted. I need you to put that money in my bank account. And the next day that money was in my account. I know somebody said, I'm holding this check. This man, I know the bank teller said, I know that Mr. L did not get a check from Oprah and didn't tell me about it. Didn't tell me or Todd about it.
You know? That's right. That's right. I love it. That is my favorite. I love that. That is hilarious.
But Oprah, yeah, she's of course, as you guys know, very powerful. I've just read and seen so many things about that. Anything Oprah touches turns to gold. Mm-hmm. So you can best believe that Oprah gets her hands on this show. It's lights out.
Hey, we're dreaming big here. We're dreaming big.
So we're gonna make sure that we let Oprah know that you guys are out there and that you have me on tonight. And I'll make sure I'll send a tweet to Dr. Oz as well, and make sure and let him know that I gave him a plug on your show.
That's right, and that's gonna make him huge after being mentioned on our show. Everybody don't know who he is.
And Oprah loves Dr. Oz. She loves Dr. Oz. So she's a big.
Not love three teachers, you know? Come on, easy sell.
You know it. You know it.
Well, one thing that we always ask our guests whenever they're on our show, and it's our typical question, but it's, has there ever really been a time in your career where you've just completely fallen on your face or made a mistake while you were in education and you just really took it and learned from it?
That happens to me every day. That's every day.
Then you're doing something right.
You know, and that's what I tell young people, that, you know, we don't expect you to be perfect. You know, as adults, we make mistakes. We make mistakes every day. So, you know, mistakes are good food. You know, we learn. Failure is motivating. Success is paralyzing. So we embrace failure. But there have been many instances. There's a kid that I kind of gave up on and thought that I had tried everything that I could, and and just did not and just didn't think that I could get through to this kid, and ended up regretting it because the young man ended up losing his life. And I just think that if I had continued to make myself available, you know, to him, he was 16 and was murdered by a 12-year-old. I lost touch with him and never went out to kind of reach out to him, and decided that I told one of his friends that, you know, his name was Willow. I said, I got to find Willow and I want to reach out to him. And he said, Principal, well, it's too late. You won't be able to reach him. And I found out what happened. It just taught me that you can never ever give up on kids, because you never know when that might be the last moment that you had a chance to make a difference in a kid's life. And since that incident, I've said to myself that I'll never ever give up on a kid again. Now, of course, that means I have subjected myself to many, many, many things that I don't think I deserve, because I just do not want to give up on kids or their parents, because I've had some situations with some parents that have gone to some levels that have been very difficult. Just some denial issues and just defending bad habits and just enabling children to not do the right thing. And I work real hard to try to get parents to understand that they're not helping their children when they support them when they're wrong. Children want structure. Children know discipline is a form of love. But I also know that parenting is not easy. I'm a parent myself, and I know it's difficult. So I try to remain humble and realize that it can be tough. So I, that mistake of giving up on that young man has taught me that I can't ever give up on kids or parents or any of my teachers, you know, as well. If there's a teacher who's struggling, I can't give up on them, because they're making the effort to be there to help a young person. And that's more than I can say for 90% of the people, you know, that I know on a regular basis, because many of them are not choosing careers where they can impact the lives of young people, because our schools reflect society. And our society right now is not in a very good place. It's not a good place for children. But yet there are people like you guys and folks out there in the Twitter world, people who are watching this wonderful show tonight, who have made that commitment and that dedication, who are willing to walk into a school every day and say to a kid, you can be me because I was once you. It's powerful. And so I will never give up on kids, because you guys don't, and everybody out there in the world have not given up on kids. So we're in the fight together.
So just think back to maybe when you got into administration, and if you could give yourself some advice, like, your current self giving your former self advice, what kind of advice would you give?
Now, I've learned to be wary of advice. A fool won't heed it, and the wise man don't need it.
Yeah, but that's true.
But I'll tell you one of the things that if I could have done it all over again, is that initially in my career, I chose the path of becoming the popular principal and not the successful principal. And that's two different directions for a leader in general, because I became the principal who was more concerned with whether my teachers liked me and whether my superintendent liked me and whether the kids liked me, more so than if I was someone who was pushing them to be successful. Even if it meant I was making them uncomfortable, but I was pushing them to be successful. And because I chose the popular principal route, I right away, everybody loved me. I was well-liked. I was the greatest guy in the world, but my students were struggling. So if I could do it all over again, instead of waiting 2 or 3 years to have a meeting with my staff, which I did, and I said, hey, listen, your principal is a new man now. No more will you teach where you want to teach. No more will you teach who you want to teach. You will now teach where I think you need to be and where you know you need to be, but you're afraid to go, but I'm going to help you go. Now, the problem for me was early in my career, most of my teachers were my babysitters. They were in my wedding. You know, so I said, can I afford to piss these people off to the highest of festivity? I don't think so. But I said, if I don't, I will lose lives. I've got to find a way to save these kids. And so I started moving teachers from third grade to fifth grade, and teachers who have been teaching fifth grade who need to be teaching younger kids. And I had a teacher in fifth grade who needed to be teaching seventh, eighth grade, but she was afraid. I moved her, and she told me, if you move me to seventh, eighth grade, I will never speak to you again, Principal L. And I moved her, and I said, I won't change my number if you want to call me, but I need you. And her students became so successful in seventh and eighth grade, and she's never, ever left. Even after I left the school, she stayed in seventh, eighth grade. That's because awesome. That was where she needed to be. But it took me to be able to get the courage to not be afraid of the conflict. Because as administrators, many times, and I know I was, we can be afraid of that conflict. But it was other leaders who taught me, and my pastor at church who taught me, that the price of leadership is conflict. That we need to be willing to take on those battles so that our teachers and students can be successful. And so I just tried to work as hard as I could to begin to push people and not be afraid, but consider their feelings, but also understand that the bottom line was that my children, my students had to come first. Their success had to come first. And what I found was that the teachers respected me more. The kids respected me more. That really my superintendent liked me even more. Sure, he loved having the person that no one called him to complain about. But now when they called to complain, they complained about the fact that we needed more things to do for our children, and our children were more successful. And so if I could do anything over again earlier in my career, I think I would have taken on those challenges to push people to go get out of their comfort zone, to go into that learning zone, which is very close to the frustration zone. Uh-huh. And that as a leader, that's the toughest job. But if we're willing to take that on, we'll find that our students will become successful, but also that our teachers will be successful as well.
Well, with everything that you've done and you've learned, what are you passionate about right now?
I am passionate about making sure that every principal in the world understands that culture in the school is so, so, so important to the success of everybody else, not only in the building, but outside the building. So I am passionate about making sure that I'm supporting and helping principals and teachers to understand that, number one, as a leader in the building, we're the prime facilitator of culture. But also that if we're going to build resilient teachers and students, because our teachers need emotional resilience as well, because I know some teachers who are burning out, and it's only October, that we need to be able to support them, that they need to know that we will be there for them, that if they I wrote a blog for ASCD, and I said the teachers and students need to know if they need it, that we will build it, that we will make it happen, and that is our job as leaders, that we make sure that our teachers need whatever it takes to help those students become successful. And so I want to help them develop a culture in their schools that will help to develop resilient students and teachers. And teaching students to be resilient is not about teaching them to be successful. I want everyone out there to understand that teaching students to be resilient is about teaching them how to respond when they're not successful. See, that is a skill that many adults don't even possess. How am I able to look up when I can't get up?
Right.
How am I able to overcome these obstacles that just seem so difficult? Because I know that success only comes before work in the dictionary. I must continue to work hard if I'm going to be successful. So if I had to be passionate, I'm passionate about a million things. But if I had to be passionate about one thing, it's about helping schools, helping principals, helping teachers develop culture, a culture in their schools, in their buildings, where we're developing and building emotionally resilient teachers and students, because then we will begin to see success in every school, because those students and teachers will be able to overcome any obstacle.
Right.
Very
amen.
True.
Amen.
Amen. Amen.
That's right.
Church. Church. Later.
Man, that's a,
and it's I like, know I'm preaching, and I know I'm preaching to the choir, but the choir needs to be inspired too.
Well, and the choir needs to hear it sometimes as well. I mean, and like you were just saying a minute ago, a lot of us, we get beaten down sometimes, and we need to be reminded of the great things that we are doing, and that we can't forget that we're in it for kids.
You know it. Kids first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we really appreciate you taking the time to be with us, especially late on a Wednesday evening when you got stuff going on. And so we really appreciate it and getting a chance to know you a little better. And I feel like those bonds will only get better on Twitter and the Connected Educators and all that great stuff. It's really good to get to talk with people like this in a face-to-face.
And when you come to Texas, you got to hit us up so that we can meet up and hang out.
I am. And I'm on Eastern Standard Time, so it's an hour later.
That's right.
Than it is there. And one thing I want to say, in closing also, is I want everybody out there to understand that this show, that my message, it's not about one outstanding educator. There are thousands and hundreds of thousands out there in the world. And because of shows like this, you are able to get a chance to see some of the work outlined that oftentimes you don't see, because some of these other shows don't want to highlight the positive, the good things that are going on. But I appreciate what you're doing, but I want everybody out there to understand that's not what I'm promoting, and I know that's not what you're promoting, that there's only, because Hollywood loves the story about there's one person who can go in and teach a bunch of kids a ballroom dance and they become successful. It doesn't work like that. It's years and years of hard work and dedication and commitment, but because of people like you guys who are willing to get the word, to spread the gospel about the good work that's happening with educators, that they're edu all-stars out there. You don't have to be a Major League Baseball all-star. You don't have to be an NBA all-star. You don't have to be an NFL all-star. You can be an educator and be an all-star. There are people who are going to make sure your story gets told.
Yeah, appreciate you validating what we do. That was our goal when we started this thing, and I just really appreciate you validating that.
Thank you, guys.
So, just quickly before we leave, if you want to connect with us, you can find us on Edu All Stars HQ on the Twitter, and we tweet sometimes under Edu All Stars hashtag. Our blog is at eduallstars.com. You'll be able to find this video and past guests on that blog. You can also find us at iTunes. If you just search out Edu All Stars with no spaces, you'll be able to find all the podcasts there.
And we have lots of great guests coming up. Though that's one thing I love about our show is we're never going to run out of guests, because there's always tons of inspiring people. But just to give all of our listeners a few heads up about some upcoming ones, we mentioned before how we had an interview on October the 1st that got canceled with the Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan. He has rescheduled with us, so we will be speaking to the Secretary on Tuesday, October 29th. So this upcoming Tuesday at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. We've got about 15, 20 minutes with him, so we'll be learning a little bit more about him. And then on the next day, Wednesday, October 30th, we'll have fourth grade teacher Paula Noggle, who will be on at 8 p.m. Central Standard Time. And then the following Wednesday, November 6th, we're going to have fifth grade teacher Pernal Rip on at 8 p.m. Central Standard Time as well.
And then we still have, Steve Spangler coming up in December, right?
In December, that's right. Steve's coming on then.
Yeah, I'm stoked about
it. And hopefully we'll be able to announce Oprah or somebody on.
hey, let's make it happen.
That's right.
So you got Arne Duncan. You got Arne Duncan coming, and you mean I'm actually going to be on iTunes?
That's right.
Yeah, you're on iTunes.
You're going to make me a star one day.
Hey, that's our goal. That's our goal. I mean, all our guests go big after they come on our show, so yeah, people will know you after this.
Well, if I go to the top, I'm taking you right with me.
But, okay, so y'all can, we just said you can check us out on iTunes. Leave us a rating and a review if you could. That always helps us out with getting us noticed. On there. Thank you again, Principal O, for coming on. We appreciate you, especially
this
late at night. Your story was super inspiring. I was kind of watching the Twitter feed a little bit, and there were some great things being tweeted out that people were being inspired by. So thank you again for coming on.
Yeah, and pray for me, guys, because this trip to Africa on Sunday, my girls, of course, at home are a little nervous about it, but it'll be my first time there. But I'm sure it'll be it'd be an awesome experience, and I just appreciate it. And this is a great way for me to begin that journey, so I want to thank you.
Yeah, will do for sure.
Great, definitely.
And I'll be tweeting while I'm there, too.
All right, good.
Take care. Have a great
night. Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.